Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got with us Simon Chalette, who's a longtime contributor to the OAM and all-time hero of mine. Simon, thank you for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Carlton and Will.
Brilliant. Simon, for me, like, okay, so I'm like flushed to have you on the show, but you're one of the big contributors to the OAM and nobody knows who you are. So before we kick off, could we tell us who you are and how you found Django and what's your backstory and how do you come to be in the community?
Yeah, sure. So when I was in uni, I discovered Python there was this very pesky HTML thing that was popping up when I was trying to connect to the Wi-Fi. It was a pain to kind of open my browser. And, you know, like, if you were trying to load an HTTPS site, it wouldn't work. So I figured out that there was a way. I was using Ubuntu at that point, and there was a way to use one of the signal emitted by the OS to kind of like book into it. And Python was the way to do it. So that's how I started using Python, just trying to avoid having to fight with my university Wi-Fi portal.
Fantastic. I love that story.
Well, it sounds like you'd already done a little bit with programming languages before.
Yeah, correct. So my dad was working for a company called City Group, Diners Club. It's a kind of like credit card thing. And they had an office in Montreal. And a couple of times per month, you needed to like work on the weekend because you need to like backups of like credit card stuff. So you had like to print everything. All like the credit card, they were printing that on paper for others.
But was it on the paper with the little dots down the side?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, wow.
Boxes and boxes of that. And there was like a crazy server room there as well. And I got to kind of play with computers at a very early age, got to program kind of like using my Visual Basic, so like writing Bash and what's the name of the Windows equivalent? Like DOS. I don't remember all the, like, I was writing like bat files and things like that. So I started playing with that. I played video games after that and trying to automate a few things that maybe I shouldn't have. But like I was kind of like obsessed with these games and wanted to, like, it turned into, I like more the programming aspect than playing the game itself. So I had like a background in programming before using Python. I worked in a web agency developing websites in PHP, and maybe my first contact with ORM-like stuff is that we had this in-house PHP framework, like a lot of agency had at the point. We had a database connector logic that was mainly talking to MySQL, and we had a customer that wanted to use, I think it was Access or SQL Server, I don't remember exactly, but I had to write a kind of like connector for that, kind of like port to the logic that was dealing with kind of like pagination and all of that stuff. So that was kind of like before Python was doing mainly PHP, and there was a framework as well that was popular before jQuery called Prototype.js. And the community was not that open, but I kind of like, I contributed to a certain extent, was reporting bug to it. And I remember going on a camping trip with my parents and kind of like being obsessed with this thing and just printing the source code on the paper and just carrying it with me because I wanted to read it all. So that was all kind of like pre-Python stuff. I did PHP and JavaScript, I guess.
Yeah, cool. I've got this vision of you being like the girl from Jurassic Park, being like, this is a Unix system, I know this.
I was more kind of like R level before that. Like I didn't add like a lot of the focus on kind of like the OS things at that point, but I like computer stuff, and I was exposed to it at an early age because of the job my dad had.
Yeah, and like the tell there is that you were already using Ubuntu when you went to university, and so
yeah, that's what tripped me up. I was like, no, that's not a, and that's, I think that's for people learning program. That's the the thing is that some people come in with years of experience and some people, it's their very first programming class. And so it's sort of like, if you can get through that first year of programming, most people can catch up, but you don't know that someone has, you know, in no other subject does somebody have 5-10 years of experience, but in programming that can be the case.
Yeah, that this experience kind of like oriented my, let's say, career choice as well. So when I got to college and uni, I mean, I didn't know what to do really. There was tons of things I liked, and but I had kind of like this pull towards it because it was interesting to me, and I think it was rewarding as well because I'd say what was easier, but I had like had facility doing these things. And that was in college. I went to a college called Collège de Maisonneuve, and I was working in degree was in multimedia. So basically we're doing kind of like drawing of like 2D animations, 3D animations, and a little bit of programming. But since I had like facility in programming, it was I was very interesting because I was able to do focus on the other things basically that I eventually didn't end up working with, but kind of like gave me a foundation in kind of like some form of like video editing and like the part I liked the most was really about just the drawing. I was not that good, but kind of like being able to spend some time drawing at school was kind of like, I was not expecting that when I was in high school that you could do that.
There's something nice about those kind of the other bits, which aren't sort of, you don't think of them as your core bits, but those other bits that sort of round you out a bit, it's like make you a bit more of a fully fleshed human being.
It was a great time, like being able to just explore. That was kind of like the college part, it was really cool.
Okay, and how did you find Django then?
So the agency where I was working at was they had a consultant, and one of the recommendations the consultant gave them is that in order to speed up their development process, they should adopt a framework because like a lot of agencies, they were maintaining the old PHP framework. And the consultant was someone coming from a Python and Django shop, and he was kind of like trying to push for that, but they wanted an external assessment. So I was there and I was kind of like this PHP guy. I didn't know much about Python except for the script that I wrote for Wi-Fi stuff at the uni. And they asked me to kind of like do an assessment because they had a trust relationship with me. And we evaluated both Symfony and Django. And we decided to do a complete 180, moving from a PHP shop and going to towards Python and Django. And that's how I ended up using it. I think my first contribution was a translation that was not properly done in, I think that was even like before TransFX, but I ended up kind of like creating a ticket for it and started contributing to a few more things, issue that we ran into. And eventually Claude Paras wrote to me on, IRC and asked me if I wanted to help with contributing a bit more because I was kind of like submitting something every weekend. I guess that was how it worked at that point. You just had to be so pesky that they wanted you in so you could help instead of bugging them.
You just had to keep turning up, right?
Yeah.
Oh, this guy again, right? Okay.
Well, it's interesting hearing that story about how even when you're younger with prototype JS, like it didn't occur to you not to reach out, you know, because I think a lot of people think frameworks or software is, you know, people over there do that and I do this here. But as you found at an early age, right, if you show up, it's especially open source, like people are dying for help. So it's that leap, though, is a big one for people, I find, you know, later in life, right, because they have imposter syndrome and all these things as opposed to just doing it incrementally and then so yeah, that's a smooth transition from, you know, being like, oh, here's this new thing and oh, something's wrong. Like, of course I'll fix it. I think that's still something people don't think about or don't know where to look or don't think that it could really help them.
And I think the Django community and the Python in general is a good example of like trying to do things right and being welcoming in terms of trying to provide guidance, being open. That's something that I think made me fall in love into Django, with Django, is that, but my experience with Prototype.js, it was kind of like a wall. It felt like I couldn't, I was suggesting something and it was kind of like, there was not kind of like no discussions. And I get that Django is a large project as well. It's possible that newcomers sometimes run into more of a, maybe a pushback against and some things, but I still do feel, and I try to embody that to a certain extent, to try to be as welcoming as possible, while maybe maintaining some boundaries as well, because we're humans and we don't want to burn out, obviously.
So did the entire consultancy then switch for all its projects from PHP Symfony to Django, or is it just on that specific one?
It was a prototype project, so we wanted to, thinking of it now, it was great that it was kind of like metric based. So we had like two or three developers that we knew that we had a similar projects using our framework, and there was like a new engineer as well, or in there, like it took a lot of time to onboard on the previous PHP projects. We wanted to compare that, and even with the fact that with the language barrier, basically they needed to learn a new language, and deployment as well at that time was not as easy as it is now. That was kind of like maybe 15 years ago now. I don't know, like that was a long time ago. And we still ended up being kind of like flush while learning all of these things along the way. So then a few more projects were added, and they ended up switching entirely. Obviously, they needed to maintain the PHP projects, but the new projects were created using Python.
The thing that you said a couple of times during the introduction, during that the story there, was that they were like everybody else at the time. Everyone was maintaining their own in-house framework. And I think that for me is the big one. It's like, why use a framework? Well, because if you don't, you're going to end up inventing one. And the one you invent just won't be as, it won't be as good.
Yeah. And the whole kind of like onboarding was kind of like spoke to me a lot during that time, because like you don't have to maintain like any form of like documentation. You don't have to keep up with like the latest security vectors discovered. A lot of like the batteries include there by kind of like a peace of mind that allows you to focus on not being in the business of maintaining this kind of project. So it's a big plus. And I think a lot of people realized it at that time, kind of like the rise of Symfony, Rails, Django, kind of like it was that time when folks started to realize that, yeah, there's a benefit in kind of like putting all that together.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Did you poke around Rails at the time as well? Because that was also the other big one. Did that come up or no?
Not during the review there, when we kind of like compared the technology. I played a bit with it, but I'm the part I did the most was kind of I'd say reverse engineering, but kind of like looking at how they were doing some things, just because I was curious. Because I mean, it's kind of like, let's say, a sibling of Django to a certain extent, right? They grew along over the years, so it's always interesting to see how they're doing things and how they're taking the project. But no, I've never kind of like chosen it and used it for a project myself.
So I wanted to ask you about your work, because you work at Zapier, right? Which is a bit, you know, it's a big company and a big Django shop. And, you know, can you tell us about your life there?
Yep. So I previously, prior to Django, I was working at I founded a startup that was yet another email marketing platform that was focused on new laws that were coming into effect in Canada about kind of like spam laws with regards to explicit consent that you need to renew when sending email marketing. And company were eager to be able to just comply and make sure they didn't do anything they shouldn't. And there's also this dynamic in Quebec and kind of like maybe more the eastern part of Canada around just bilingualism, to be able to send email campaigns in both languages.
Yeah.
Tools like MailChimp and such, they do a bit of that, but it was not, we were kind of like trying to target a niche there and focus on these kind of like two big features that users in Canada and mostly in like Quebec were eager to get. So I worked there for 5 years, and that's kind of like the time I started computing more and more to Django, because we were doing things with kind of like dynamic models and kind of like all sort of crazy things that needed me to dig into like what the ORM was doing, or like bug NC, a contributor at the time, about, oh, well, this thing is, you have an idea how we can do that. But yeah.
So this is the secret. Is basically you get to be, because you're basically the main, or one of the main contributors on the ORM for the last few years, and your depth of knowledge is just astounding. So the real trick there is that you're trying to push it to its limits, you know, for a long period of time, and you slowly accrete that knowledge, that depth.
Yeah, I got a good interest as well in just a relational database. Like every time I try to look at them, I read about them, I find it fascinating. The way they implement these kind of like low-level primitives that can be used to do, like nowadays, tools like Postgres, I mean, you can use it for so many things when you start. There's everything in there that relates kind of like data or synchronism across in a like distributed service. So it's fascinating to me, and it was also fascinating to be digging there and see the discussion around like the expression APIs that was added, the work that was done as well for NC by to try to just make things better. That was very interesting to me, and had the chance to be exposed to all sort of like these discussions, because I was invited to Django Under the Hood for I think the 3 years in Amsterdam. And that was kind of like very kind of like I felt like I needed to give back, because everything that was kind of like given to me there in terms of, I mean, it completely changed my life. I was kind of like included in this group of folks that were even, I'm just indirectly mentors to a certain extent, kind of like being able to watch how they work, how they approach problems, and just maybe get things done in a context where it's hard sometimes to drive consensus. Then there might not be like a right answer. There might be some that are better than others, and at the end of the day, we need to make a choice. That was the thing that pushed me towards the ORM, trying as well maybe to fill a bit of the void in this area, because it's kind of like an important part of the framework, but it's, if there's no kind of like keeper of the knowledge there, it's easy to maybe repeat errors of the past. Tests can only do so much in terms of telling you to not do a particular thing.
Yes. Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, I guess that leads in. How do we, it's something you talked about in your DjangoCon keynote in 2022, but how do we encourage contributions to the ORM? Because it is quite big and scary, and it is quite complicated, and it is quite difficult. But how do we keep it so that there can be new people coming on board to pick up and pass the baton onto and keep it fresh?
I think that we need to put help with some guardrails. I think the code base is, once you wrap your head around it, there are obviously parts that are more intimidating than others. For example, things that relate to join pruning and things like that. These are kind of like non-trivial to reason about, but most of the time you don't have to go that deep. There's two layers, and they could be better documented. Something that three things that I mentioned at the end of the talk was a form of like mentoring. I've been kind of like looking at the side about what like the projects like Django Nuts are doing, trying to maybe find a way to contribute there and chime in, find a way to mentor developers that might be interested in digging to that. So that's on my kind of like 2024 to-do list. We'll see if I ever get to it. But other things we could do that I was against at first because of the burden mine posed, but any form of like typing as well in terms of like self-documentation, I mean, I guess it could help, because if you have like your IDE, and tools are so good nowadays in terms of like generating codes or like guiding you to a certain extent, that you can get 90 percent of the way there. And that's enough to kind of like just start wrapping your head around all of these pieces. And obviously documentation, but that's a large effort. And there's a tax with documentation. If we need to like to keep it up to date, it's one more barrier to kind of like trying to change things up in this area.
Yeah. So you said a couple of things in there. One, you said earlier on dynamic models. Let's come back to that in a sec. You just said about typing. Do you see that a way of incrementally introducing typing into Django?
Yep. I think that in like the past releases, we started to maybe like the past four release, five releases, we started to kind of like document change to the database backends change. Even if like if they're not documented, we're still pointing like, oh, if you use this particular method, you might want to do that. So that might be one area where you start typing it. Maybe trying to incorporate things from project like Django Stubs could be one. I mean, a lot of the work has been done there. To me, the immediate benefit in terms of like maintaining the ORM tool would be more around adding it at a lower level. So more in terms of
sort like of inside.
Inside, yeah. So we can at least kind of like play with it, see how much of a burden it is, setting up CI pipeline as well. And MyPy provides like us or other solution for enforcing typing. It's also a bells and whistle to kind of like do it in an incremental way because it was developed at the point where there was pre-existing code base that didn't have typing. So from my experience on other projects, at Zapier, for example, it works pretty well, like the gradual typing. Sure, there are new things that you need to learn about. Typing can be intimidating, partially in the case of like Django, where we do kind of like some meta class magic in some cases. Yeah. So you have to... It's not as easy, but I think there are real benefits there in terms of self-documenting code.
Well, let me ask a question. So Zapier for, I think, 7 years, what kind of projects do you work on? So you've mentioned that they're very supportive of you doing open source work, but is it like one big project for multiple years? Do you have different ones? Like what does the day-to-day look like?
I would say it's kind of at this point, it's more like multi-month project where I more kind of like try to support many teams in terms of features they're trying to deliver, engineering problems they run into. There might be a couple of times where I have to write a piece of code because I have knowledge about many systems and just getting the teams together to do it would be hard. So sometimes I just kind of like create proof of concept or actually deliver, let's say that like high impact code that allows for the unblocking of teams or prevent like lifting of dependencies between two teams. So otherwise, a lot of mentoring, a lot of trying to come up with a way to drive alignment within the company around the technical vision is something I've been working on in the past few months. So that's changed a lot. When I joined, I was my title was product engineer, and I just kind of like revolved around the workflow part of the product, which is like very interesting. Again, it's kind of like the, let's say, the equivalent of the ORM for Zapier. It's just fascinating, this kind of like huge distributed system that you can just throw a workflow definition at it, and you see you want to trigger off something, and it does its thing, and it's resilient in the face of like the thousands and thousands of APIs that can return very various response code, and you need to make sure that some things are idempotent, and like it's very interesting from a software engineering perspective.
So it sounds a little bit like a software architect would be like a title I've heard for what you're doing, and that you're not directly managing people, but you're overseeing large groups of engineers and providing guidance and occasionally coding, but largely helping them figure it out on their own. Is that accurate?
It's a good definition. I think it's about that. I think it's a, I wish I could code more. And I think that Django is the kind of like escape from that, but I've realized that, the more I code, and others as well, and they try to make it explicit to me because I like coding, obviously, but I can have way more impact by empowering engineers, developers within Zapier to actually ship code themselves and kind of like be a vector of that. It's you know, like the writing code and shipping it and seeing it deploy and like all this machine, the reward cycle is so immediate that it's easy to get trapped in there, while you can be way more impactful doing other things.
Well, that sounds a lot like so Andrew Godwin has also most recently had a software architect title, and it seems like that's about as good as it gets as you progress in a company, because companies want you to manage people, but if you want to still code a little bit and have impact but not be doing as much managing, the software architect role is the way to go. But then you need, it's almost like you need open source just to code or code for fun, because you're removed from it. It's a weird thing, right? Like there's no other, maybe because I didn't grow up programming, there's most fields, you just do what you're doing and you get better at it and you just do it. But coding, and I guess most engineering fields, very quickly, 3-5 years in, you're just really pushed to provide guidance rather than do the work yourself. So it's an interesting dynamic, again, not coming from a programming background growing up, but sounds like you're managing it well.
Yep. It's at first it was hard to kind of like explicitly extract myself from there, but kind of like, as I said, the reward cycle is not immediate. It's kind of like longer now, but when you see these things happen, even if you just had like this indirect impact on, you know, like putting this little cog in this whole delivery thing, it's so much rewarding to see that you've kind of you've helped still to a certain extent, because that's the thing that I believe is rewarding for me, even for Django. It just feels like, you know, you helped to a certain extent someone with the problems they're facing, and just the impact of it as well. So yeah, it's different reward cycle, but still very rewarding.
But you do have quite a lot of availability for Django, it seems. Like, you know, when there's an issue, you're always there to help field it. So Zapier must be supportive of your contribution.
Yeah, the feedback I've had was basically, as long as it doesn't affect my kind of like performance at work, it's okay. And so yeah, I do. I like the Django stuff. I like the ORM thing. So I gravitate towards that. And sometimes it's just kind of like just a nice break of sometimes the problems I'm dealing with at job are more kind of like organizational. So kind of like going back to Django is just a nice way to kind of like clear my mind and just maybe put things in perspective as well.
I mean, so from Zapier's point of view, there must be two sides to it. One is that obviously your knowledge of the ORM is an asset to, you know, their ability to maintain a product and your ability to maintain the products as a team. But there must be, and Simon gets a mental health break as well by, you know, contributing a bit.
Well, I'd say number three is also Simon. Anyone who works with Django enough is going to come across you, and it's a recruiting tool, right? Like, I mean, I would think that'd be a big draw to work with you if anyone's interested in Django, right? If I was a company owner, recruiting is always the problem. So I think it's hard to quantify, which is sort of the issue. How do you quantify someone's time, you know, on the steering council or the security council? But, you know, if I was looking to apply for Django work, if someone was a, you know, very involved, that would be a huge draw.
Yeah. I think there's obviously there are kind of like benefits for Zapier as well. So I think that's one of the reasons why they're motivated by that, but it's great to have this flexibility. It works well for me. So I'm glad, but yeah, you're right. Like I'm able to help in house for sometimes non-trivial questions about how things should be done, or we have like a very large mono repo, like a very like old Django project, like created like, I don't know, like 12 years ago now. And it uses like a huge MySQL cluster and tons of other databases. So there are stuff that come up that we need to come up with solutions that are non-trivial, and having some knowledge about the ORM certainly helps.
Okay.
So I think Zapier is primarily MySQL. Is that correct?
The project that was created a long time ago, that was kind of like it's called like the monolith, is MySQL and Postgres. So we use it for like all the historical models are there, and all the new ones were kind of like trying to break the monolith, kind of like have each domain use a separate database so we can kind of like maybe stop its growth to a certain extent, because you start to run into issues with team boundaries, the kind of like domain violations that Django kind of like allows you to basically create a foreign key across like everywhere. I heard you called in a previous Django chat talking about the old kind of like /user profile thing as well. We kind of like went back and forth about, because the project was created before a custom user model was supported. So we've got this model that when Django switched to having custom user model, it felt like an atrocity. But the more I think of it, I think it's great that it's kind of like separated. So all that to say that I support you in this on this front. I feel like it's there are pros and cons basically, and because these models can grow very large.
That's it. There are pros and cons. There are trade-offs, and it's not like it's clearly the case that this. But in my experience, much smaller scale projects than Zapier, but it becomes a dumping ground. It becomes let's just throw another field on the user model, and then that's fetched every request. It's like, no, this isn't. We're not encouraging a good pattern here, I think, is the bottom line. And so there may be some projects where don't get rid of the ability to swap it by all means, but as the recommended path, I don't know. And again, it's, as you say, trade-offs.
But it's so well documented, this. I mean, so I'm giving a talk in 2 days at Django Boston, largely just cribbing Carlton's ideas. So I'm going to give Carlton credit about the Django user model. And I mean, 12 years ago, Russell Keith McGee put up a whole wiki with the five, and it's more than five options when they were talking about what to do. There was like 1, 2A, 2B, 2C. And even then, just pros and cons. And, I think Jacob at the time was sort of in favor of option 5, which is more what Carlton's going for with just an identifier. But, there had to be a BDFL, Benevolent Dictator for Life decision, and they chose, the custom user model approach. So it's just fascinating that it's not anything new and it's documented. They had to make a decision. And
Russell's talk he gave at a DjangoCon about it, that when it was introduced.
Yeah, red user, blue user. Yeah.
And it's a great talk, and you're nodding all the way through, and you're like, yeah, that's right. And I think it's, but, late this coming back to it, I'm like, let's change it. Anyway, that's a thing. Simon, I wanted to ask you about, have you got something to say there? Simon?
I think it's the idea of swappable model, I think it's great. Like users have been asking that we lean in to that a bit more. I think the migration framework is ready to a certain extent. Andrew spent, and all the contributors around the migration stuff as well, spent a lot of time kind of like making that better over the years. So I think there's value in kind of like providing abstract-based class. And in most cases, like having a single user model is going to be fine because you're not going to end up with like 50 fields that makes like the tuples in the database so large that fetching them for every request is going to be problematic. So I think it makes sense. And I wish we were leaning more a bit towards swappable models. I know that not everyone likes them, but I think they're a clever idea.
One thing I wanted to ask you is talking about migrations is I'd like a kind of concept of sort of bolt-on migrations where it kind of an optional one. So I've got this package that makes the email field unique on user model. And all it does is it comes along on the app installs, it adds a constraint, and then it's got a migration that you run one time, and it just all works smoothly. And if you wanted to uninstall it, you just reverse the migration and pretend it was never there. Do you think it would be feasible to do a bit more along that? I mean, it's a kind of a horrible monkey patch, just a proof of concept that you can do login by email very simply with the default model. But do you think there's a possibility of kind of optional migrations that third-party packages could provide. Say, look, if you want this, do that.
I know there's a way. I guess you could have like different app configs that possibly. We've not done that extensively, but I think the idea when Aymeric worked on app configs would be that there would be different kind of like ways you could install the app. You could install it multiple times if you wanted to with a different label by subclassing it. And they would have kind of like a different label. I don't think a lot of package lean into this idea, but I think that was the idea behind the some of the refactor there. So maybe there's a way there by using like a separate app config that have a different migration module or something like that. But the challenge still that will always be there is that if you start applying migrations for one path and you want to move to the other one, then
how do you go back?
The migration framework is likely going to trip on something because it's not designed in a way to when you can kind of like remove pieces that easily from what I've seen.
It has to sort of be off from the main trunk. It has to be clean apply and clean unapply. Otherwise, you're going to go into a world of pain.
Yep.
Quite quickly. Okay. I just wanted to get your first take on that as to and.
Yeah, that's my hot take.
So go on, I'm going to ask you one more thing about hot take, then I'm going to let Will have a go. I'll ask you about SQLite, because there's been some changes recently that are going to come in. And I remembered after, I don't know, DjangoCon something or other, 2022, we were just talking because Simon Willison had done some benchmarks on, you know, using SQLite, and I know Tom Dyson has spoken about using it in production as well. And I remember you sort of saying, but, you know, if you need access from multiple servers and multiple front-end servers and things like this. So can I ask you about SQLite and, you know, your take on that and then the recent changes that have come in?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's interesting, kind of like the evolution of SQLite and its recognition just within the industry in terms of like this like very solid tool that you can basically write to disk faster than and organize it than you would otherwise if you're trying to do your own file system interaction. So I think it has the perception of SQLite in the industry has changed a lot in the past 10 years, where it was previously more of like a, I wouldn't say like a toy database, but more something that you would use for development or so on, to a moment now where folks are like building solutions that use SQLite in a distributed manner, where you can have like multiple things that are writing at the same time, distributed amounts. So the game changed a lot with regards to SQLite, and there's a lot more interest in trying to use it in scenarios that you would have possibly used more like something like Postgres or MySQL in the past. So the benchmark that Simon ran were very interesting in terms of like seeing how far we can push it. And there was some, at the time, there was some discussion as well in terms of tweaking some mode there. It was the something that relates to how transaction behave when you open a transaction in terms of like when the lock is acquired. And a recent change that was merged in was to allow to specify through a database option how do you want it to behave, basically. So previously, the way it was working, when you open a transaction, there was no lock that was immediately acquired because you could have like read-only transaction. In this case, you don't need to have this contention. But the moment you try to do a write, if the database was already locked by something, you would get an error. And what this thing is, this new flag is allowing you to configure is to have the lock be immediately acquired, which can have like some impact on contention and is not going to be working well if you use the atomic request setting, because that obviously opens a transaction for every request. So even if you're only doing reads, which is the case for a lot of web application, you're going to run into issues. But if you want to do a lot of, if you have like a different scenario, you're going to try to push the limits in terms of delivery, that might help, because otherwise you might get errors that are, you basically have to litter your code with try statement handling possible exception when doing writes because the database is locked. So, and there's something else as well that's being discussed with regards to changing the write ahead log or something setting. I've not followed that one that closely, but yeah, two settings that should make it easier to use Django with SQLite to a larger scale soon.
So Zapier will be moving to SQLite, or
I don't think so. Okay. I think we're there's not. We use SQLite for something that was very interesting. We moved away from the solution, but we have a system that injects webhooks that are coming from all over the place. And obviously, you need to make sure that you never lose a webhook, right? Because if you do, then Zap might not trigger and the service might not be smart enough to kind of like retry if it runs into a 500 or something like that. So one thing we used to do was to, we used to mount volumes directly on these boxes and pods that were ingesting these requests. And we were writing it kind of like an audit log in sharded by minute, I believe, SQLite databases. So we would, if we, in the catastrophic cases where the queue was down or something like that, this thing could keep ingesting and we could open the machine and run a script that would open these thousand database and replay. So kind of like a write ahead log in front of a queue written in SQLite. And that worked very well for us until we moved to another technology eventually.
Okay.
Speaking about APIs, I need to ask, have you played around at all with Django Ninja? Have you had a chance?
Yep.
What do you make of the current API landscape in Django, right? Because there's Django REST framework, which is great, pretty feature complete, maybe not so active. And I hear a lot about Django Ninja. How do you analyze that situation?
We have this exact debate like a few months ago in terms of like what should be used. New projects that are spin up within the organization, a lot of them use Django Ninja because like most of the time when you spin up new projects, they're going to be prototype, but they're like you're going to try out things, and the ease of development around Django Ninja, developers like it. They feel like they're more productive using it than Django REST framework. For large projects, though, we haven't run into a point yet where we need to kind of like. We miss the batteries includes of DRF. The large project that we're created with them use it, and it's sometimes very explicit in terms of like not the boilerplate, but like there's way more like bells and whistles that with Django REST framework that you get with Django Ninja. In these projects, we keep using Django REST framework, but in the new ones, like a lot of them are opting for Django Ninja instead because. It works better for them, and we're eager to kind of like try things that makes development easier for some of these projects.
And a sort of related question there is about the kind of the serialization part of it, like the explicit serializers, which sort of were inspired by the Forms API versus the kind of newer Pydantic inspired approach. So what's your experience there and your thoughts there?
I really like, you know, like I'm more of like the DRF person myself because I've used it more and I know how to find my way around it. But I think that the appeal of Pydantic is good. I mean, people are kind of like, it feels like the Django was developed in a different time, right? Like with meta classes, yeah. There was nothing of like the nice DSL that you can get today with typing. So I get where it's easier, it's faster, and yeah, if we're honest here, like this Django was developed today with like the typing things, things would be very different in terms of like what the DSL looks for model definition. So I get why people don't want to pay the tax of this software was developed when typing didn't exist. So I still need to kind of like do these things. And I mean, even with project like the Django stubs and such, you don't get as much. Help from your IDE and things that you get from Pydantic because I mean the typing is obviously easier to interpret. That's the feedback I've heard from folks that prefer to use Django Ninja.
Okay, good.
So the last question I wanted to ask is about the security team and the steering council. What do we say about these? I feel like let's start with the steering council, right? Because this in many ways replaces the benevolent dictator for life. And it's the most prestigious position to have, and yet, like, so what how has it been being on there, and then where would you like to see it do more or less around making decisions like typing for Django?
Yeah, I think there was maybe a misinterpretation of like what the role was. Like, there was a lot of discussions about like the technical board should get involved more in that, should kind of like drive the technical vision of the project, and so on. While it never really happened over the years, I think it was first interpreted as more of a just replacement for the fact that we didn't have kind of like more, didn't have like the core was dissolved, and we needed some folks to be there to kind of break the status quo in terms of like, we need to take the technical decision here. So kind of like ping us and we'll be able to provide some guidance. So I'm seeing how Django kind of like organically evolves and kind of like try to add a few things. I'm not sure like the involvement from a technical board in terms of like driving the vision would be necessarily beneficial. I do feel like it happens organically to a certain extent, and trying to like the features that are going to be highlights are kind of like self-imposing to a certain extent. And do we really need them in terms of like, do we need like a shiny feature every release? Is Django at the point where we need to kind of like reinvent things over kind of like being stables and keeping up with the latest development? Yeah, and it's interesting because if you look like other projects, like for example Rails and such, they're very much driven this thing in terms of like developing new things and new paradigms and so on. And Django has not been that. And is it okay? Feels okay to me to a certain extent to have Django kind of like take this position. Do we fear? I don't think it will make Django irrelevant by just keeping it its current pace, is what I mean.
I think we've seen that with like templates, to make one example, right? The fact that Django hasn't been changing so much means that now with HTMX, it slides in nicely, right? Whereas Django could have easily gone off in these different directions and now maybe be questioning that. So that's just one example that comes to mind about being a little slower maybe pays off.
Yeah. And there are tons of projects, like, for example, like just the async, Tishan Carton, you work a ton on that with channels and such. There are these kind of like new paradigms that are being included, and we slowly get there. And even if the technical board wanted to kind of like say like, oh, we need to kind of like go fully async, or we need to do this or that. I mean, we've got fixed kind of like release dates. It's all contributors, benevolent folks that are there. I'm like, is it going to help kind of like trying to put these things? Is it going to strengthen the community even more in terms of trying to meet these objectives? I feel like it's the way it happens is kind of good. Like, if it's ready, we're going to make there. Yes, there are some features we're trying to get in and focus more because we want to put a highlight there, but it's happening at more of a sustainable pace than if we were to try to set these objectives. At least that's my take on it.
No, I think async's a good example in that it's taken quite a few years to go from nothing to where we are, but it's actually quite mature now. And it's not the fully async, you know, brand new web framework. If you want one of those, there are those to choose about. But if you want to add async to your Django project, it's really there and it's good, and the streaming responses and disconnect handling we've added, and you know, all these things, they're great. They're wonderful. And yeah, it's matured over time. So
the security team, which you're on, I just want to shed some light on that, because that's often held up, I think rightly so, as one of the gold standards, that Django is fantastic with security. So if I'm a developer and I find what I think is a bug, I email the security team. And then on your end, what does that process look like?
Yeah, so we review the report. We try to kind of like assess whether or not it's a false positive, whether or not there's an exploitation vector there. Assuming there is, we will let the submitter know, and we will be working on our side in terms of providing a patch, or with the submitter in terms of providing a patch the problem. In some cases, like if we look at like the recent ones that were we shipped like security corrective for, a lot of times it's kind of like around regexes, things that are they look benign, but like if you start kind of like pushing kind of like crazy user input in there, they start to misbehave. But yeah, that's the process basically. It gets submitted, and before we release anything, we submit a request for a CVE to tie it to the release itself and the commit message. And from there, all the supported Django supported version of Django are going to get backports, and assuming they're affected by the vulnerability, and the author is going to be accredited. But yeah, what the security does basically is look at these emails, make some assessment, and from there determine, is this a problem or not? We get reports for Django related projects as well. I know that in the case of like Django REST framework, we had some recently as well. And we try to redirect that to the folks that are involved with these projects, or try to see like, oh, is there any other part of Django that might be affected by a similar problem? But yeah, that's about it. There's also kind of like a recent discussions about the inclusion, how we can get more folks involved in there and ensure the parity of the team going forward. I think Carlton, you can talk more about that. The push there by Michael Manfrey was about possibly using the pipeline of new contributors as a way to get more people involved in security.
Yeah, I think my thought that I threw in there was that the triage and review team might be a nice onboarding route there, because there's a certain trust element in being on the security team, in that it's confidential. And so it can't just be, oh, I want to be on the security team. Well, you need to be known and trusted. So the triage and review team is a nice on-ramp for that, because you've already been around the Django project for a release or two and you're known, and that might be a nice way of doing it. But I think, again, it's important that we think about the stability and about the continuity of the security team, as well as, you know, just as much as the rest of the Django ecosystem and project. So that's there. But one thing, Simon, we have to say is thank you for your service there, because that's, you know, it's a thankless task at times.
Thank you both as well. Like, you're driving the community like that. I know how people in Django get very excited about just listening to Django chat and seeing you just revolve around the community as well. You've been just, stars of Django.
Well, they should be excited about, you know, the security team. That's the thing, is that the real work is happening in the dark.
It's black ops.
Yeah, I think work is happening everywhere. Some of it is more facing, but it's awesome to know that it feels great to be kind of like in this distributed entity and seeing it kind of like continue to work, evolve over time. Obviously, there are things would like to evolve faster and so on, but it's great to see it grow. Basically, I've been kind of like revolving around it for more than 10 years now, and it's an awesome project.
Okay, so we're coming up on time, Simon. So I a couple of weeks ago we had two fellas from Pen Planet, which is an app built with Django, and Andrew there is the expert, and he asked, I had a question I promised him I'd ask you, which is, he's from an SQL background and he's used to, you know, working in raw SQL, and then when you jump to the ORM, and he's very capable and pleased to be able to construct equivalent queries in the ORM, but his point was they often don't look very much like the underlying SQL that's generated. But, you know, perhaps you have to use values in a weird way in order to get the grouping right. Or is there any way that we can make the relation between the ORM query and then the SQL more transparent, is in your view?
Yeah, the big challenge with the ORM, and something that SQL Hacking doesn't have, the ORM query builder doesn't have this intermediate notion of tables. So everything relates to models. Sure, there are kind of like aliases that represent tables, but one thing that SQL Hacking has is that there's these two kind of like layers. Like, you've got the kind of like table representation, you can bind models to them, and you really have a query builder. You have like a lot of flexibility in terms of like, you can use tables directly and use like exist clause here, kind of like this join here, and so on. And you can then kind of like pipe that into a model representation. The ORM doesn't have that. The kind of like compiling part is heavily coupled to the notion of a model, which make things like any form of like union or addition of like eventual common table expression, the with statement in SQL, or things like there was discussion about a subquery wrapping and things like that. There's a fine line in terms of like providing very high level abstraction while still allowing low level injection of logic. And that's, I believe, the big challenge with Django. And you look at like primitive that were recently introduced, like filtered relation, for example, that tries to kind of expose that. It tries to do it, and it for complex cases, it fails to a certain extent, because the ORM very much needs to be able to know what kind of join it's dealing with regards to eliding them and optimizing them and making sure that the query still makes sense in the context that you make. So I think that's the kind of like biggest challenge in terms of providing more flexibility to folks that are maybe have a DBA background or very familiar with SQL and want to turn the ORM into doing what it wants. So that's a big, let's say, problem or design issue with the current state of things. I know NC brought up a few like years ago that might be beneficial for the ORM to kind of like be built on top of SQL Alchemy, so people could like drop back to just doing these kind of things. But that's too big of a ride for me. I'm not ready to to venture there and support this multi-year venture.
Right. Okay. So then, the I guess the question is, if you put that on the side as something that we're not going to do, do you have a kind of magic one that you would, you know, if I could fix this, I'd fix that. If I could change this, I'd change that.
Oh yes, there are tons of things. I wish we were doing a better job at kind of like buying more into removing a bit of like the extra stuff. So today, most of extra is obsolete. What one thing that remains is around the queries of extra allows you to do a few things like select new columns, but order by or where and there. But all of that can be emulated using raw SQL, the expression itself. You can like import from Django DB models raw SQL and wrap it and pass it directly to filter and order by. And the fact this is carried around all over the ORM makes it. And the fact that it's like kind of like not that well supported in all cases makes it very awkward to use. So like finally pulling off the band-aid on extra, kind of like deprecating most of its option and coming up with a nicer way to do reference to tables, either being through joins, common table expressions and such, I think could push them a bit even further in terms of like what is doable without going through a massive refactor by introducing an intermediate table representation.
Okay, brilliant.
Anything else that we didn't ask you about or you want to plug before we sign off?
No, that was great. Just wanted to say that it was great to be here. It was great as well to listen to you all. It's great to be part of the community. And if there are, again, I want to reiterate that, commit to it. I want to kind of like get closer this year to either like Django Knots or any form of like similar projects to find a way to kind of like do a form of mentoring. If you have questions about the ORM, about the PR pull request, you can ping me on Track as well. I do my best to try to support you through that. And I learned about the ORM by just trying and breaking things and moving things around, so it's only a matter of like trying, I guess. So it's a lot of stuff, but it's certainly manageable once you play a bit with it.
Okay, awesome. That's very generous.
Thank you for coming on. It's truly, when we started this podcast, one of the guests that Simon that Carlton wanted was you. You were like this mythical figure that hadn't been to like recent conferences and worked on the ORM, and so you know, to meet you at DjangoCon US 2 years ago. And then now that you're on, like you were like one of the top five people, Carlton was like, we need to get this person on when we started this.
Only took me 140 episodes to pluck up the courage to actually invite you.
Yeah, I'm glad that you invited me. It's glad to be here. I'm glad to be here. And regarding conference, possibly I'd be able to be more present. I think that the past years, I had another surgery last year and other things. It's just, and I played Ultimate Frisbee before during the exact season where all the conference were happening. So it didn't work out. But yeah, looking forward to possibly meet you in person at the next events.
Brilliant.
Well, thank you. So everyone, we are at djangochat.com and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.